There is a question which crops up again and again in the minds of people. Am I making progress? Am I getting on? I think that is not quite the right way to look at the situation. As far as the religious life is concerned, and realization of transcendence is concerned, what is the meaning of the word progress? How shall we measure the immeasurable? It is an unnecessary question. Never ask it. Be quite free of it. Consider for a moment what lies at the back of this question. Is it not a self-concern? It's about me. Am I progressing? And the word progress in our ordinary world has meaning in terms of gain, of personal stature, of this separate self, which becomes more and more separate the more it is emphasized, enhanced, the more it grows. You see, at the back of that question is the egoistic feel. Am I progressing? Where am I to progress to? Nowhere at all. Transcendence is here all the time. One only has to awaken to it. And that awakening cannot be measured. There is an analogy in our worldly life. A person finds happiness, say, in going to a dance and just hearing a little bit of pleasant light music and dancing for a while. He's completely happy. Another person will feel fully satisfied, uplifted, with a sublime, magnificent performance of some fine work, a Bach Mass or Beethoven Ninth Symphony or the late quartets or something like that. Now you and I know the difference between the two. But for each of those people who finds full happiness, this one in this situation, that one in that situation, he has found fullness. And that quality of fullness is immeasurable. So never ask the question, am I making any progress? If we can remain really wide awake, then that is all that is required. If you look at another aspect, look at this question from another aspect, we can see it this way. If a person is making an account of his virtues and his vices, he will have a guilt conscience about his vices. He will torment himself quite unnecessarily with all those things. And he'll get neurotic and psychotic and whatnot about it all, won't he? So this question, am I making progress, is somewhat related to that. Oh, I'm not making progress, this is awful, I'm too bad, and all the rest of it. You just make the matter far more difficult and worse for yourself. So don't ask the question, am I making progress? But remain wide awake. That is all that is necessary, to remain wide awake. Now in this wide awakeness, there comes in the great question of meditation. Have we sufficiently questioned why do we want to do meditation? In order to make progress, comes the glib answer. In order to attain wisdom, in order to achieve this, that, or the other, in order to realize a state of beatitude, is not all that centered in me, myself? Is it not another form of selfness? But to be in meditation, to be in communion, which is the natural, normal situation intended for the human being who is fully human, in the profound sense of the term human, to be in such communion is perfectly right and proper. And that is meditation. But what is perfectly right and proper and natural is never measured. One never even sort of starts thinking about it. Do I start thinking about the coursing of my bloodstream in the body? It just goes on quite naturally because the body is healthy. The heart beats. The body breathes. It carries on all its living processes quite naturally, easily, with a kind of an at-homeness about it all. Now, as and when meditation, the living of the religious life, the holy life, becomes that sort of thing, well then, it is right. Of course, it will immediately be asked, well, how do we realize that kind of meditative state as a permanent, as something permanent in our lives? The question is natural. But it is natural for the self-oriented person. For the person who is not self-oriented anymore, the question just never arises. He is in meditation all the time. Whatever he is doing or thinking or feeling, he is awake. He is aware of what he is doing and how it is happening. He is aware of it. Not as an external observer, an observing subject looking on at an object, either the event or the situation or the person or whatever is being done or whatever is happening. Now we must really get into the deeps of this and get into it very quietly and easily. Remember that meditation or deep prayer, if you're the theistic type, if you're the contemplative type, the devotional contemplative, then you call it deep prayer, you call it realizing union with God or whatever it is, you see. and so forth. Meditation releases power. It releases a power you and I are unacquainted with in the ordinary way. It releases power out of the deeper aspects of mind. Power which is immeasurable. It's an energy which is not of this type of energy which is the whole of the physical universe. Nevertheless, it is there, and it is immensely powerful, this energy. And one of its effects is that it intensifies both the good and the bad in us equally. And this comes as a shock to many. It comes as a shock to everyone, perhaps. But meditation, especially the types of meditation which we may commonly call tantric, they release power. If you meditate upon God, we'll just take the word God for convenience. If you try to sort of get inside yourself in this deeply devotional spirit and give yourself to God and so forth, that will release a power out of the depths of the mind which will intensify our virtues and our vices equally. I want you to just hold this, concentrate attention upon this very carefully. I can give you a physical analogy. When it rains, the rain doesn't choose upon what or upon whom, on which field it will rain. It rains. And if it rains thus, and there is a range of mountains here quite near the sea, and if it's a heavy shower, it will wash away all the topsoil and cause harm. But if it doesn't do that, in another part, it will fertilize the fields, feed the rivers, and all the rest of it. But all that happened was, it rains. It rained. The sun, it just shines without choosing upon what or whom it will shine. That rainfall is like a release of power. That sunshine is a release of power, of energy. And it does not choose what kind of effect it will produce. The effect depends upon that which, upon the nature of that upon which the power works, falls. I, composed of virtues and vices, with the release of power upon me, will find both my vices and my virtues intensified. You look at it through history. Who were the inquisitors? Those who are a little bit too concerned about religion, about God, about saving souls, weren't they? Who was responsible for crusades? If you look at human history, you will see that this is a fact. This release of power from within intensifies the good and the evil indiscriminately. Then you will say, but what hope is there for us then? Is there any way out? And the ignorant will say, yes, fight the good fight all the time. Fighting the good fight is precisely the way to spoil the situation. I cannot fight evil. I cannot cultivate good. These are illusions. This evil, this good, which I as I am know, are part and parcel of one whole duality. We don't appreciate that. One man says, this action is kind. Another man says, this action is cruel. Both are approaching it from different points of view, with different levels of understanding. What is the action, kind or cruel? The inquisitors cultivated zeal for the Lord, and in their zeal, see what they did. The British people were more interested in football than saving souls, so they developed more or less a sort of a tolerance, which has been very helpful in the world. If they didn't have that tolerance, but had zeal for the Lord, how would they have behaved in India and in China, as the Portuguese did, introducing the Inquisition and so forth, or trying to? So you see, this business about virtues and vices is a very relative business, because we, being what we are caught in this sphere of duality. We live within the ambivalent sphere all the time. This ambivalence prevails fundamentally because we are self-oriented. Everything is from my viewpoint. And my viewpoint is determined by how this psychophysical organism feels and reacts to everything that happens. What is pleasant for me, I call good and virtuous. What is unpleasant for me, I call evil and vicious. So you see, if I'm aware of some vice in myself, I define the opposite virtue. But who am I who is defining this opposite virtue? I am the ignorant one, the confused one, the deluded one who emanates hosts of illusions, all sorts of illusory ideas. They are a mixture of the true and the false. And if I have a virtue, or which I call a virtue, I will define the opposite as the vice, But again, I, the definer, being faulty, will necessarily make a faulty definition. I can't escape that. That is a fact. So, we must realize that we are caught in this sphere of ambivalence. It's a word which modern psychology uses quite a lot, you know, the love-hate ambivalence which prevails in the world. With the one hand we love, with the other hand we hate. And if we look at our behavior, we find that it is a mixture of these two. And there's another thing. Anything which we call a vice holds within itself the seed of its opposite dual. Anything that we call a virtue holds within itself the seed of its opposite dual. And these duals constantly interplay. What comes up in my conscious mind as something generous and so kind and magnanimous and so forth produces a reaction in the inner depths of the mind of the very opposite, which I don't see. If a desire springs up consciously thus, its opposite is there in the deeps of the mind. The opposite desire. You see, all this sounds perhaps rather trite and very simple. But don't let's get deceived by the apparent simplicity. It goes extremely deep. What we have to see is that we are caught in this realm of ambivalence. If we fight evil, if we try to cultivate good, we are caught not only in this realm of ambivalence, but always we are self-centered. I want to get rid of this. I want to gain that. Now, is that quite clear? See, we really must understand this. Because if one really understands, one can get free now. Here, today, this moment. Our whole consciousness is caught in this sphere of duality. We as we are. To use the Buddhist word vijnana, our vijnana is a tainted vijnana. All the time. For whatsoever it cognizes, whatsoever it plans, bears that taint with it. And therefore you can never get wholeness, holiness, out of a tainted vijnana. If my hands are dirty, I can't clean another object with those dirty hands. That is our condition. We must recognize that. That is to say, we must really see that that is the fact. Not merely with the brain. Just reel off a set of words in our mind saying, oh yes, my vijnana is tainted. Having said that, you do nothing about it. Johnny said, Mama, your hands are dirty. Yes, ma'am, my hands are dirty. But if he really saw that they were dirty, really saw it from within himself with his whole being, he'd go and clean them. Now, Therefore, let us be quite certain that within the sphere of ambivalence, animated by any sort of self-concern, there can be no such thing as spiritual realization, as religious freedom. Now, seeing that, let us look into this question of mindfulness. Being attentive. And you know the Buddha laid supreme emphasis upon satipatthana, did he not? Supreme mindfulness, samma sati. Perfect mindfulness, unceasing mindfulness with respect to body, feeling, thoughts, everything. It's a 24-hour job. You are mindful in your sleep too. Now consider the nature of this attentiveness. Supposing someone is kicking a dog and you say, John Brown is a cruel beast kicking that dog like that. Don't you? Or if you see somebody being helpful to some poor person in a crowd who is perhaps a little bit blind or whatever it is, you say, how kind John Brown is. Or we say the same thing about ourselves. I am a jealous, thoughtless person, or I am a generous, amiable, helpful person, and so forth. Don't we? Now let us be quite certain about this. Is that or is that not the way in which we are aware and mindful? But now, being aware in that manner means that we are always caught in the sphere of ambivalence. We are always feeling and thinking in terms of my sorrow, his sorrow, her sorrow, or pleasure, as the case may be. And we try to solve the problem of my sorrow, his sorrow, or her sorrow. Now, if we set about it that way, we will have 3,500 million sorrows to solve. That's the world population today. Can you or I do it? And I, who am sorrowful, how am I to solve somebody else's sorrow? The blind leading the blind. Now, this is the key to the situation. Now, if you get this key, you will solve the whole thing. That is, the whole thing will resolve by itself. Instead of saying, this is my sorrow or his sorrow, say, this is sorrow. Don't say mine or yours or anybody's sorrow. This is sorrow.
And if you are really sensitive, if your whole attention is given to it, you are attending to the world's sorrow simultaneously. You are sensitive to it. You are aware of it. And you are aware of it with no self-orientation involved in it. There is no self-centeredness there. Either directly in terms of your own self or indirectly by identifying yourself with the other fellow. Your sorrow is my sorrow, my dear, kind of thing. No, this is sorrow. The total thing, the world phenomenon. Now, I have started this way because it's a little bit impersonal. This is sorrow. Now, let us look at something else. Instead of saying, he is violent, or they are violent, or I am violent, say, this is violence. Now, what is the result of that? One of the very important results. If I say, John Brown is a cruel beast, I feel antipathy towards him, the person. I can hate him. This week, we have witnessed a traumatic event in the desert through the hijacking. Men, women and children who have been made to suffer, and their relatives and friends have been made to suffer. Incredible suffering. Any one of us who has been through deep sorrow knows what that kind of thing means. The anxiety, the fear, the horror, and what was my reaction. Hate against the perpetrators of the cruelty, of the evil, is it not? If one is sensitive at all, the first reaction is terrible hate. In the name of justice, of decency, of humanity, such and such people ought to be punished severely, etc., and it is all involved with a tremendous emotion of hate. Anger, cloaked under the name of righteous indignation. Whether anger is righteous or unrighteous, it is anger. Whether a fire is a coal fire or a paper fire or a wood fire, it burns. It'll hurt. But if, instead of being attentive in terms of the person being like this, I am attentive in the manner I have suggested, this is violence, then I'm likely to remain free of hatred against the person who is violent, which is a great blessing, because my hate is a violence. All the thoughts that may go through my mind about justice being executed are forms of violence to compensate for what this person has suffered through that person's violence. But these are all forms of violence. And the violence in the world doesn't disappear then. Now take the opposite. Somebody is very kind and generous and always ready to help and loving and considerate and so forth. What happens? We say John Brown or Mary Smith is like this, that, and the other, you see. So we get attached. And with the attachment, there are demands going out from ourselves. There are expectations that he or she will remain on that pedestal, or God help him or her if they ever do anything which upsets my image of virtue. Is that love? Or just another form of the usual human stupidity? But if I see this is generosity, then I remain free of attachment and false valuations of the person. This is so important. Now you see, if I remain free of hate on the one hand, or attachment and so forth, and false valuations on the other hand, then there is the possibility of a pure and right relationship with the person. And under those circumstances, there can be healing in the real sense. Now, I've put it in terms of the other person being violent or other person being kind, the same with oneself. Because all the time these reactions arise within oneself, don't they? All right. So if I see in myself, this is violence, and not in terms of Firoz is violent. Because if I am aware of the situation in terms of Firoz is violent, then I shall dislike Firoz. I shall want to punish him. I shall want to suppress him. And then the whole rigmarole of nonsensical procedure goes on. Unpractical, that's all. Thoroughly unpractical, that is. But if I am really awake to the fact this is violence, then you know what will happen. And I am awake to it without fighting it. On the one hand, without giving in to it, on the other hand. You see, I neither fight it nor do I gratify it. Then you know what happens? What happens with the psyche and with your understanding under those circumstances is similar to what the body will do in any situation. For example, you are enjoying a walk. Let us say you are on the South Downs. You come right to the edge of the cliff. The body quite automatically will not go over it. It sees this is a cliff. You see? And to drop here means death. The body just won't do it. Similarly, when the psyche sees, really sees, like you see with your physical eyes, this is a precipice, the body, the psyche just withdraws. That is all. You don't have to fight the precipice. You can't, in fact, with the body. And it is the same with the psyche, the psychological condition. Now, I don't want you to believe this. I know it is true, but that is quite another matter. Don't just believe it. Investigate it. Don't reject it out of hand. But investigate it continuously, every moment of the day. See whether this does happen with the psyche. take one of the problems which is common to all mankind and has been ever mankind was, in fact ever since animal creatures were. The tremendous sex urge that human beings suffer from. All right. Look at it. Don't fight it. Don't gratify it. Just keep looking at it and seeing that this is that particular thing. That particular storm will quieten down. There is no ocean of the world where a storm rages permanently. It subsides. And if you fight the storm, what happens? You can't fight the storm. Every good sailor knows he never fights the storm if he's caught in it. He uses his skill to manipulate his way out of it. I am telling you the skillful way out of the raging emotion. Watch it. Just keep quiet. Keep absolutely quiet, still looking at it. Knowing that this storm is raging, don't gratify it, don't fight it. Don't say, this is, you are evil, down with you. No, not that way. This is what it is, right? Now, if the story just ended there, then we can just go on for the rest of our lives in this round of experience. But that is not the case. When we really see like that and are attentive in that manner, a peculiar power of intelligence emerges from within, accompanied by a peculiar power of quiet and peace. This is not something which is imposed upon the psyche. This is not something which you can win by struggling for it. It emerges out of the depths of your own being. And you will find extraordinary consequences associated with this. When you see that this is violence, and the seeing is a complete seeing, and the psyche just remains whole, and the violence vanishes, then the opposite of violence vanishes with it. The opposite of violence as defined by me in my dualistic state. So what happens is, not that I get rid of an evil, not that I gain a good, but I am free of the whole sphere of duality at once. My petty kindness, cruelty, generosity, miserliness, magnanimity, meanness, all of them just disappear. The duals disappear. Because these duals are defined by my consciousness, self-oriented and caught within this ambivalent sphere. So you see, There is no fighting evil. There is no striving for good. But the release out of the ambivalent sphere, when this release takes place, there is the emergence of a transcendent power out of the deeps of the mind. And it comes from universal mind, not from what we commonly and mistakenly call my mind or your mind. Now, this means that you, the whole person, are in communion, are in meditation in the real sense. By such mindfulness. This is tremendously important. This, as far as I know, is the real key how to be mindful, the right way of being mindful, which spells release and freedom. We suffer from so many compulsions, don't we? All of us have some sort of compulsion or other, physical or verbal or emotional or intellectual or whatever it is. An intellectual compulsion, and let us say an aesthetic compulsion. We are always having tunes running through our brains, or seeing wonderful pictures, or indulging in all sorts of fanciful imaginations and so forth, compulsively. We are caught up in this. It's an escape from reality. It is a shutting down, a clouding of reality. Then what we try to do, when the compulsion becomes too great and troublesome, we run off to a psychiatrist or psychoanalyst or whatever it is. Well, all right, use a crutch, but don't let us get deceived that we are becoming whole. We are using a crutch. If I have an accident and one leg is amputated and I have to hobble along on crutches, well, don't let me pretend to myself that I am walking happily and merrily. I am not. I am using crutches. We must be perfectly truthful with ourselves. Now, this release into the wholeness, as I have already said, means that one is in the state of meditation, in the state of communion. And when one is like that, you will find that there is an indescribable inward stability and strength. You are in the condition of true comfort. You are not being comforted by another. In the sphere of ambivalence, we are comforted by another. There's just a little jam upon the burnt toast. You see? But this comfort from within is strength from within. It is your natural state. The state which was intended by evolution. If you are a theist, intended by God. this condition of strength, which is the condition of peace, of stability. And you will find that in that condition, you are awake to the whole world of people and of things without any aversion, without any attachment. When you are free from this bondage, these chains of aversion and attachment, because you have gone out of the ambivalent sphere, then through you there goes out into the world unceasingly transcendent love, understanding, beauty, happiness. You just radiate the spirit out of yourself, like the sun radiates light and heat to us. Just naturally. You are like that. You are that kind of being. The religious being who has really flowered out. Then, when you witness violence, for the person who is being violent, there will be only compassion. For the person who is suffering from that other man's violence, there will only be compassion. There will be no taking sides for this one against that one. You will be free from conflict. And if you are free from conflict, you can help to establish peace. Otherwise you can't. Have we not the proof of that in human history? All these alliances and treaties, do they establish peace? Do they establish love between man and man? Not a bit of it. Every one of them is self-oriented. By people who are greedy, hateful, hating, stupid, incapable. Isn't that the fact? If not for the terrible tragedy associated with it, it is almost a comedy in our own lifetime. Italy was our ally in the First World War, was our enemy in the Second World War. Japan, the reverse way. What stupidity, what criminal idiocy this is, which we human beings perpetrate. But let me not say he is the criminal idiot. This is criminal idiocy. And if I really see it, then the psyche just moves away from it. And pure mind comes into operation. And it is the release of pure mind and its power into operation which is the real significance and value of what we commonly call meditation. So now you see, the problem with which we started was how do I, the impure person, caught in the sphere of ambivalence, meditate, knowing that meditation releases a power that it intensifies both the good and the evil. So now, don't meditate, starting with the self, by saying, I must cultivate such and such virtues. This is a mistake. The meditation has to be totally unself-centered. And if I can't be totally unself-centered, I am playing with fire. In meditation, you do not have a pair of tongs with which to hold the white-hot coal. You've got to hold it with your own hands. Ordeal by fire. This is its inner spiritual meaning. And if your hands are pure, you will hold that fire in your hand. Has anyone of you ever seen one of the Komana Garden favorite pictures of Zarathustra, the founder of Zarathustrianism, the great teacher in Iran? You all know of the religion, Zarathustrianism, sometimes called Zoroastrianism. You see? Now, Zarathustra, in this picture, of course, looking upwards, you see, perfectly seraphic expression, and he's holding a great big globe out of which there issues fire. Atar putro ahure mazdao, fire the son of Ahura Mazda, the Supreme Being. He holds the sacred fire in his hand, just like that, the actual live fire. Meditation, in the true sense, is this fire. But no self-orientation, no desire for gain, no desire to destroy what I call evil. The cosmos holds everything, doesn't it? It transforms all the time. It doesn't destroy. It seems like destruction to us, but actually it is a transformation. And only out of purity, only out of the release from this bondage of ambivalence, can such transformation take place. So, pay complete attention with utmost intensity, in utmost quiet, with complete dispassionateness, and maintain the white heat of it. Maintain the white heat of it until, and you will know when the time has come. You see, yes, this is violence. And it passes away from you. You don't run away from it. It passes away from you. Apply to any and every problem, apply to any and every success or pleasurable situation. Because they are both imposters. Pleasure and pain, virtue and vice, they are both imposters. Be even more intensely wide awake in the midst of what is happy and pleasurable, because that binds with devilish success. Look at the way we go after the pleasurable. I know in my own life, for example, concerts. Oh, so-and-so is playing. This is going to be performed. Wonderful performance. The avidity, one can't believe that one can be so greedy in one's soul. When I was in Berlin in 1925 for a fortnight, I went to 18 performances in a fortnight. The Ninth Symphony, the Mass in B minor, performance by a famous quartet, the whole of the Ring, Parsifal, Zauberflöter, and violin recitals, piano recitals, and a song recital. This is greed, isn't it? The pleasurable, the hankering after it. How it binds. Now, if somebody tells me, last night there was such and such a performance, absolutely wonderful, never heard anything like it. And my only response is, it doesn't matter to me at all whether I heard it or didn't hear it. I enjoy it if I am hearing it. If I am not hearing it, I am perfectly happy. As a matter of fact, yesterday, for instance, immediately after the group at 6 o'clock, Alfred Brendel was giving the performance of the Hammerklavier Sonata, which is very rarely performed. It requires a superb artist to give a good performance. I knew that was going on, but it didn't worry me one bit. And when everybody had gone away, Sylvia told me, there's still a little bit left. I didn't bother to go and hear the little bit left. But you see, once you really see these things inwardly, there is the state of freedom in the soul. This is important. Now look, we have talked a lot about this. I didn't intend to talk so long. Let us spend a few minutes actually looking into something. Now, with every one of us has something unpleasant happened today. Somebody being unpleasant, having a row with somebody, or receiving a letter or news, or getting annoyed with somebody for some reason or other. Or has there been something very pleasant? And if you are wise, you will choose the devil which is pleasant, because he's the more difficult to deal with. You see? All right, you select any one thing you like. Any one thing. Got it? Clear in your mind? All right. Now, just let the body be perfectly free and easy, free of all strains and stresses. Ease right through the body. When the body is quiet and at peace, then it is truly in touch with earth. Let the breathing be comfortable. Now just visualize the particular event and the person or persons. And if it is not today, whether it was day before yesterday or during the week in the office or the shop or wherever it was, just look at it. First see the shape of the event, the person or persons involved, the nature of the event, pleasurable or unpleasant. Get the whole picture complete in its detail, or at any rate in its main outstanding outlines. Now look intensely, with intense attention, at the nature of the event.
this is unpleasant, or this is pleasure, dissociating it from oneself and the other person or persons. If the mind wanders, just be aware of the fact it has wandered. Because the mind wants to run away from facing the fact. The moment you are aware of that, attention will once again come to the matter in hand. It may have been a situation where an injustice was done, or where someone was a nuisance, or oneself was a nuisance. Whatever it was, see it as this is so and so. Do see it dispassionately. Whatever it is, supposing it is pleasure, see that this is bondage. Don't struggle to get free of bondage. Just see, this is bondage. And you know how the Buddha hardly passed a day without speaking about the bondage which emerges out of the pleasures of the senses. This is bondage. the attachment. This is pleasure, this is bondage. Just see the fact with intensity. And as you see the fact, what the Buddha called nibbindati will take place. It has been translated as he turns away in disgust. Leave out the disgust part of the translation. Nibbindati in this context, I think, really means that he becomes completely disinterested in. Your interest can be one of aversion or it can be one of attachment. Neither of the duals binds you. You are disinterested in pleasure. You are disinterested in the unpleasant. You are free of bondage, in other words. Nibbindati, the turning away. And this is what the Greeks and Europeans called, Christendom called, the metanoia. The transformation in consciousness because of the turning away. The natural turning away. Like the body turns about after it reaches the edge of the precipice. Keep attention fixed, concentrated. Let the mind be calm, neither hate nor attachment. You will feel that calmness as a strength. And in that strength there'll be peace. There will be understanding, both for what one commonly calls oneself and also for what one commonly calls the other person. Understanding. Not excusing, poor fellow, he can't help it, and that sort of nonsense. Understanding. This is how it is. And how it happens. Very good. And with peace, in the atmosphere of peace and understanding, there is compassion. No emotionalism about it. this mysterious reality called compassion, which you and I don't know with our brains. Don't let's fool ourselves. Rest. Practice this. All day, every day. Supposing our work is such that it entails constant conversation with others, customers or friends or whatever it is. Whilst one is conversing, be mindful, be awake. What's going on here? Am I getting annoyed? Look at it. Or am I getting a little bit anxious or anything? You see? And see, this is annoyance, this is anxiety. You can carry on the conversation, be awake to it, and be awake with tremendous intensity. Don't say, this fellow is so foolish, he just doesn't understand, he's wasting my time, it's no good. No, a wasting of time is taking place, that's all. Then you won't hate that person, nor will you criticize yourself. And in that state, there is a subtle inward relationship which brings about communion. Meditation takes place and should take place throughout the day. You go to a restaurant to have your lunch or tea or whatever it is. You look at the menu and you see the price list. You see, this is expensive. And you may judge quite rightly, this is exploitation. Yes, this is exploitation going on, that's all. See it very, very clearly. If you don't want to participate in the exploitation, you will naturally walk out of the restaurant. And that is all there is to it. No, you know, this is very serious. The religious life is daily life. Divorce it from daily life and I am just the usual hypocritical, self-indulgent fellow. Indulging myself with religiosity. But be intensely awake all the time. I know, for instance, as I'm talking, that I make these movements with my hands and so forth. I know all about that. I know when I talk with very great earnestness, there's a tendency to get tense here. You see? And so forth. I'm perfectly aware of it all the time. I'm mindful all the day, all my waking day, certainly. I'm really mindful. Very rarely do I find that I'm caught napping now. It's perfectly natural. It's effortless. It is there.
That is why there is peace. That is why I don't seek anything at all for myself. I need a certain amount of physical comfort, otherwise the body would simply collapse and become a nuisance to others. That is why if I'm asked, for instance, to give a lecture in some distant place where I have to stay overnight, I make quite certain beforehand that conditions are all right. If they are not, well, I'm sorry, I can't undertake it. And that is all. There is no demand for me, the great lecturer, that he should receive such and such. Not at all. Just be completely mindful of what is going on and how you are going on with it. You see? And you'll find that unselfness will be your natural state. Then you are a true human. And through you, there will go out love and peace and compassion, generosity, patience, forbearance, all these things will be there. You won't have to strive to be patient. Oh, no, I must be patient with this fellow. It's so un-Christian, it's so un-Buddhistic not to be patient. The Buddha said patience is the highest austerity, it is nirvana. He did actually, in the Dhammapada you'll find it. Don't do it that way. That is struggling to be good. Then you're caught in the realm of ambivalence. But just be mindful, this intense, wide-awake mindfulness. See, this is religious living. And use your senses. Let every sense be wide awake. Sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell. Everything be wide awake. Because if I'm not wide awake with every sense at its highest pitch all the time, I'm a little bit senseless, am I not? See, we can learn together, can't we? So we meet. And insofar as we meet, because love makes us meet, and not the desire for gain or the calculation, oh, I must go and listen to this fellow or to that, go to this bhikkhu or that priest or that lecturer or whatever it is, because he's so marvelous, he has such a lot to give. Oh, my goodness, you might as well go to the, what do they call them? These betting shops in order to gain something. It's no different. Or if we go in order to get a little comfort and a little consolation and a little this, that and the other, well, you might as well go to the pub and have one over the eight. Unfortunately, the bulk of humanity does do that in order to be consoled for the day's sorrows and sufferings. But this is a very sad fact. So have you really understood this today? Because this is so important. Every vice holds the seed of its opposite virtue within the sphere of duality, of ambivalence. and vice versa. Every so-called virtue, as defined by my tainted vijnana, holds its opposite. To fight the evil, to try to seek and cultivate the good, are both mistakes. But be attentive, mindful, dispassionately, dissociating the thing you're mindful about from the personalities involved, saves you from hate for the person or attachment for the person. And when the psyche really sees the thing for what it actually is, it turns away from it naturally. Nibbindati, metanoia takes place. And there is the liberating factor. And if any one thing in the dual, in the sphere of duality, is seen completely like that, it and its opposite both disappear. Now, another thing which I haven't mentioned yet. Not only does one duality disappear, but the whole of duality disappears. All dualities disappear. You are out of the whole sphere of ambivalence for this reason. You haven't got to travel through all the dualities and get out of them. Once your consciousness, your awareness has undergone this transformation, the whole lot of illusions are out at once. You are full of light. It is not like, not as in the case of the body. Supposing you have half a dozen diseases. You got gout in your toes and cirrhosis in the liver and cancer in the throat and cataract in the eye and so forth. You see? It's not like having one operation after the other. Not at all. In the psyche it's different. This thing, consciousness, lights up. It has seen. And the psyche is at peace. It's calm. See, the whole thing is done. With any one thing done completely. This is the wonderful part of it. This, if you like, is the generosity of the eternal. It is like this. We say, so near and yet so far, don't we? Where heart's desire is concerned. Transcendence seems so far. And the first step is the long step. But it is the only step. Once the first step is there, there is a non-stop stepping. The whole thing proceeds in the right way. But you must know how to take that step. And this is what I've tried to put before you today, clearly. This is violence. This is magnanimity. And see it with such intensity that all the definitions that I have about magnanimity or violence, they all disappear. And the whole psychic complex, the complication, disappears. And you get enlightened. You're free. And you remain wide awake. And you never have to ask another person, am I doing the right thing? You never need to go to another person for advice. You are mindful, intensely mindful, and you awaken. So you see, this, as I say, is the key, the real key to get utterly free of the whole realm of ambivalence, of duality. Then you will know what happiness is. Yes, George?
Is this possible for a person who hasn't studied perhaps Buddhism or Hinduism or hasn't got a spiritual?
Is your power of mindfulness dependent upon your study? Belief in the doctrine is a hindrance. You must go to all this with a completely open mind. If you have beliefs, you will have a kind of a fossilized faith instead of a living faith. Living true faith is a living power that wells out of your living being in your actual immediate consciousness. But a fixed thought form, this belief, that doctrine is a hindrance to it. Look, George, when you go, say a friend takes you to some new part of the country which you haven't seen before, do you have any pictures in your mind of what it ought to be beforehand? If so, you are going to miss the real beauty of it. You've got eyes, you can see. All right, go and see. Don't have any doctrines or beliefs about it in that way. See, constantly see. Hear. The doctrines, the beliefs, the teachings, the systems, you can read about them, they will all come. But don't grasp them or don't think that you've got to have something like that beforehand. Not a bit of it. The power of attention is the power which is in your living organism. If, for example, you have suffered some brain damage or you're utterly senile, well, you just can't attend after that. You're done for. That's that. No amount of indoctrination will enable you to see the truth then. You see, you say Buddhism. You might just as well say Christianity, Islam, Voodooism, Totemism. Any one ism is as much ismic as any other ism. No. Not beliefs and doctrines and so forth. You know the meaning of the word mindfulness, don't you? Well, the meaning of the word mindfulness is not Buddhistic or Christian or Zarathustrian or Marxist or Leninist specifically. Not at all. Everybody in the world knows the meaning of paying attention. Everybody in the world knows the meaning of it. Pay attention. That's all.